and more. HD radio allows you to hear multiple programs through additional digital channels. The sound is crisper than FM, and your choices are expanded. Visit kpft.org to learn more about HD radio broadcasting and program schedules. This is commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio, 90.1 FM and HD1, and now alternative programming on HD2 and 3. KPFT, Houston.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender community. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening, this is Jack Valinsky.
And Jennifer Renee.
Brian Levinka.
Daniel Williams.
Summer Iman.
And Glenn Holt. And tonight on Queer Voices, Josephine Titsworth will be joining us shortly to discuss the 2011 summit, which will be held at the University of Houston this coming weekend. For the third consecutive year, the ACLU will be represented at the summit. Then in News Wrap, the annual conference of the American Psychological Association has approved a strong resolution in support of marriage equality. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control report an alarming increase in HIV infections among young African-American men who have sex with men, and anti-gay forces have the green light to circulate petitions for a proposed ballot measure to overturn California's new law requiring public schools to teach about the contributions of LGBT and physically challenged people to the state and national history. After News Wrap, the John Stephen Kellett Foundation supports a range of educational, cultural, and charitable organizations in Houston's GLBT community. Earlier this year, the foundation completed a revision of its grant application process, and the foundation's executive director, Brian Riedel, will join us to discuss those changes. At 10 o'clock, a visit with Marion Coleman, who will join us to talk about her life and contributions to making Houston a better community for all of us. In the feature segments from This Way Out, Diane Tor's Man for a Day workshops have made her known around the world as a bisexual gender transformation performance artist. A feature film about Diane Tor is set for release next month, and This Way Out has an interview with the artist. And an interview with Leslie Jordan, whom, by the way, we have interviewed here before on Queer Voices, about his latest autobiographical one-man show based on a book of the same name titled My Trip Down the Pink Carpet. And, Jack, if you're wondering, trying to remember who Leslie Jordan is, think of a small man under 5 feet tall who appeared on TV shows like Will and Grace, Ally McBeal, and Star Trek Voyager.
I have trouble remembering who I am sometimes. That's why I usually have a name tag on.
Brian, do you remember the character that he played on Star Trek Voyager?
I do not, and I'm like a huge Trek.
He was a Ferengi. Remember when they went through the wormhole and they got lost over in the Delta Quadrant or some such thing?
I just remember Sorted Lives.
Yeah.
Well, this weekend was pretty interesting. There was crowds of people waiting, and those crowds of people were like waiting for back to school supplies, waiting for, I believe there was a health fair thing, and there somewhere in one of the blogs estimated that was upwards in this city of 100,000 people. So that was the big thing that happened this week.
I mean, that was incredible that so many people showed up, which only exemplifies the need that's out there under these this economic circumstances.
Right, what about our governor thing? What about that?
There was something with the governor this
weekend? Like a third the number of people. It's way more important to concentrate on the 100,000 people who desperately needed school supplies for their children.
Well, didn't that have something to do with what the legislature did to the schools and education?
Well, that will be apparent through the next generation when people are not educated, that the public schools have been underfunded, that teachers are out of work. It's really, really sad, and you can't just pray away these things. You have to actually do action upon it.
Do something about it, yes.
Right. And, of course, there were some alternative events, and, Brian, you were helping produce one of those.
Yeah, we had an anti-hate rally on Friday night, and we had a good turnout despite it being the surface of the sun hot. But, you know, we had a couple of speakers, and it was a good rally. And our message was simple and, you know, anti-hate, not anti-religion, anti-prayer. And it was kind of a community coalition of groups coming together.
Well, and the theme I heard over and over on Friday night from every speaker was that Governor Perry and the American Family Association and their message of hate wasn't Houston. That Perry's coming in from Austin and the AFA is coming in from Tupelo, Mississippi, and Focus on the Family's coming in from Colorado. And that these people are coming to our town to preach their message, and that's not Houston.
And we were just saying, no, thank you. Go away. Oh.
Absolutely. Then on Saturday, there was a Trailblazers event of the Harris County Democratic Party.
Which was protested by the Westboro Baptist Church, who apparently liked to sing a little chant as you're walking by. It was, you know.
Yes, I stopped with a nice lady police officer and the manager of the hotel. They were standing out to one side, and I stood there with them while they chanted. And
it was like one of the family members and like some kids.
Yeah. I want to compliment HPD. They had the barricades right. They had it set up. The protesters were caged, basically. They had the barricades right to keep anybody else away from them and them away from anybody.
But my favorite comment of the luncheon was from Lou Weaver, president of the Transgender Foundation of America, who presented the award to Phyllis Fry, the Trailblazers Award to Phyllis Fry. And he pointed out that in 1977, Anita Bryant was speaking in that exact same hotel.
That's right.
And that Phyllis Fry and her wife were outside protesting.
Where the Baptist Church was.
And see where we've come from 1977, that now Phyllis is on the inside, and LGBT people are on the inside.
We're on the inside getting awards, and they're outside with their little signs.
So, that's all that happened. Next week, we're going to be asking you for fundraising. This is part of KPFT, that we're a community organization, and we count on your support. We certainly appreciate that you listen to us all the time, but we're also going to ask for your support. Also, we're not on iTunes right now. We're trying to figure that out. There's something that the station did and some change in programming code, so for some reason, it's not up there. We're working on getting that fixed, but we are on the KPFT archives. You can go to Queer Voices for that. And if you are missing the show or not able to stay up this late, you can download the show at your convenience. They're usually up there for about 2 months worth of it. And you're listening to Queer Voices.
You never close your eyes anymore when I kiss your lips. And there's no tenderness like before in your fingertips. You're trying hard not to show that. Your eyes when I reach for you. And girl, you're starting to criticize the little things that I do. It makes me just feel like crying. You.
From an EP released this year, that was Nervous But Excited Performing Just the Two of Us. Or, no, actually, it's the other way around. It was called Love and Feelin'. Well, that's a cover of Love and Feelin'. And that was Nervous But Excited from the EP Just the Two of Us. Okay, I think I got that right. Love and Feelin' from the group Nervous But Excited, the album Just the Two of Us. This is Queer Voices.
And this is Jennifer Renee.
And Brian Levinka. And Jennifer, yes. Who do we have in the studio?
There is a special event coming up this weekend. It's a two-day event out at U of H. And I have attended the two prior, it's the Transgender Summit.
Texas Transgender Non-Discrimination Summit.
Yes, I knew it was a bit longer than that. It, to me, it's just the TG Summit. But what's important about this event, and you nearly need to go. If you want to know what it takes to make change really happen, this is where you need to spend 2 days. And I'm telling the whole thing. I think we'll do the interview. Well, don't we have someone here?
I think we should interview the person, Jennifer.
Well, I'm so jazzed about it.
I know.
Well, you know what,
Jennifer? I had heard that this was going to be at Texas A&M.
Yes, and I want to know what happened. We have our guest, Josephine Titsworth, who's the organizer and the leader of the pack, if you will.
The head guru.
Well, she rides a motorcycle, so it's leader of the pack.
Yeah.
Josephine, tell us about why aren't we at Texas A&M?
Well, first of all, thank you for inviting me to be here tonight. And before I say anything about A&M, it's really important. Everyone needs to understand that most of the students there are okay. They're okay.
I went to Texas A&M, and look at me.
See what happens?
There are gays there.
There are gays there. I have relatives and friends who've graduated from there.
Yes.
The chancellor of A&M, we graduated from high school together.
Oh, wow.
So,
there's one particular student group that's just got something up there, you know what, and
they had a problem.
They had a problem. Yes, they did.
What's so good is how gracious U of H is.
Oh,
that's what's fantastic. Really important to remember is that under any circumstances, U of H has really been there for most GLBT organizations, and of course, the chancellor's statement a year ago adding the protection for transgender identity or expression was very good. It was actually instrumental in persuading HISD.
Very good. I'm glad to see this is a very cancerous effect.
Yes. Very good.
It all started with you down in
Clear Lake.
It's spreading.
Hey, this is fun. I don't know about other people, but when you get out and you start trying to create change so other people can have a better life, I can't think of anything that's more fun than that.
Oh, no, me neither.
Well, tell us about the summit coming up.
What days are?
It's going to be this coming Friday and Saturday.
Okay.
And it's going to be at the University of Houston at the Roy G. Cullen Building. Okay. The Department of English is hosting. They're providing the facilities for the summit. So it's going to be Friday. Our keynote speaker on Friday is going to be Dr. Paige Schilt. And then on Saturday, it's going to be Megan Stabler with HRC.
Friend of the show. She's been on before.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other events, too, going on, right? Speakers.
Absolutely. I mean, Jennifer, you're one of them.
Yes, I know. That was self-serving, wasn't it?
What a little self-plug
that was. It was a little self-promotion there, guys.
Why, there are other speakers, aren't there, Jennifer?
Now, do we need to say more?
No, I think we need to tease our audience. Like, what can they expect?
Well, yeah, there's a lot. I mean, yes. I can go on and on because I'm so jazzed about it. But what you can understand, and I'm going to say this, and we'll let you go. I've been given a great deal of credit for the change that was made at HISD over 3 years. What I learned from these two summits was instrumental in making that little change in other people. The way to present an argument to gain someone's support. And I learned it there. Learned it from other people. And it was networking and learning how to do it. The ACLU was instrumental in several ideas that won over the legal side of HISD.
Well, you know, the legal side is very, very important when you're out advocating, because it's not so much that, hey, look, if you don't do what I want to do, we're going to see you. That's not what it's about. What it's about is the people you're negotiating with for change, they want to know, what are some of the case laws that exist that we can base our decisions on that will help us? And that's some of the things we try and present at the summit. And we also try and present the techniques on how to engage administrations. Hopefully we can share that information.
Absolutely. What is Friday going to be like?
Let's see here. Well, we're going to have our welcoming statement by Dean Ira Kobe from the UH Graduate College of Social Work.
And what time is that going to be?
I believe he starts talking about 10 in the morning. Registration kicks out about 9 o'clock in the morning. And we'll have some continental breakfast. And there'll be food.
Food is good.
Now, food is good.
Wait a second. I remember continental breakfast, a hard roll and a cup of coffee. That's better than that.
It should be. Aramark is providing the services for that. Yes.
Now, how many people usually attend this?
Actually, it's grown every year. The word of mouth gets out on this, and people start talking.
It's kind of like the statewide conference, it seems like.
Well, it's the only, only one that addresses this process.
The transgender issue.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It, you know, we may be focusing on the transgender change process, but the techniques and strategies we try and present to everyone at the summit can be used for any process.
Right, right.
Any.
Yeah, primarily, the focus is in areas where there is non-discrimination that doesn't have gender identity or expression. How you address that issue with any organization, whether it be government or school or whether it's
community.
Just a community.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah, absolutely. These techniques work across the board. We focus in on transgender because, gosh, no one else in Texas is doing
this. Nobody else is. Yeah.
But this summit is going to be the best summit we've put on so far. Every year it gets better.
So who else is going to be there? I know you've told us the keynote speakers, but there's some other organizations that are participating.
Well, Mitchell Kittin is going to be there. Representing ACLU, third year, so now this is tradition.
Oh, that little cute girl isn't coming back? Darn it.
I know, Jennifer.
Down.
My little heart pitter-patter.
But Mitchell's the one that's working with Nikki Aragus.
Yes.
And so he's going to be there and doing a workshop. Phyllis Fry's going to come back.
Superstar.
Yeah, superstar. Yeah.
You mean Judge Fry.
Judge Fry.
Yes.
Judge Phyllis.
Here comes
Fry.
The judge.
Yes. Who is an Aggie?
Who definitely is an Aggie.
So we have, there's more than one of us there.
Yeah, we got some shout-outs going on.
Yeah, yeah.
And Deb Murphy from Hatch is doing a workshop on GSAs.
Mm.
What people don't
make... GSA, what is that?
It's Gay Student Association.
Yeah. Okay, there's somebody out there that may not be attuned to our short versions.
Community lingo, yeah.
But, you know, one of the strategies in creating change is getting that initial starting point. And a GSA is a great way to start the process, just like safe zones. Great way to start a process, because the education starts with that. And as people start experiencing people that are involved with that, then they start questioning their belief systems that they were taught, because what they're seeing is not what they were taught. And they have to question that.
Yeah. The stereotype that was created around trans people by, the shows on television that are just exploitive.
Media's bad.
It's taken almost a generation to sort of undo those things. Now, I'm going to repeat this at the end, but let's get some contact information now so people can be prepared. If you want to know more about it, where would you go?
If you want to know more about it, email txtgsummit, that's S-U-M-M-I-T, at gmail.com.
That's pretty easy.
Just send an email and say, hey, send me some information.
Absolutely.
All right.
And I'm the one that will be doing it.
All right. Now, is there a fee for this? You can't mention the amount, but there is a...
Yeah, there's a registration fee, but also we're doing something brand new this year.
What's that?
We're offering continuing education units, CEUs.
Oh, yes. That's why you need my resume.
Yes, that's why.
It'll be on tonight's email.
I'm waiting for it, Jennifer.
I know. It'll be on tonight's email. It's on my desktop, as I told you 2 days ago.
Licensed social workers, licensed marriage and family therapists, and licensed professional counselors, LPCs, can earn CEUs at this summit.
Now, that's something new, is it not?
Brand new. Now, we're charging a fee for the CEUs because that's what we're being charged, but we're not making money off. What we're being charged is what we're passing.
You're just pass through. Well, that's good. That's very fair. Very fair. Okay. Have we covered Friday?
Basically.
Okay. What happens on Saturday? What time does it start?
Saturday, we're going to start getting everything ready about 8:30 in the morning. And again, we're going to kick off with a welcoming from Wyman. I'm going to get in trouble for this. Herndon, who is the chair of the Department of English at U of H.
Okay.
And he's going to do a welcoming statement for us. And then we're going to have, this is where Megan Stabler comes in and does her keynote.
And that's going to be about what time?
Somewhere before lunchtime.
Lunchtime.
And then you are doing a workshop that day.
Yes, I am.
And Jennifer, what will you be teaching in this workshop?
We're going to talk about actual activism, and we're going to be talking about the story of how HISD went from intransigent to welcoming. It was a 3-year process.
Yeah.
However, you know, it used the principles they will have learned from Friday and Saturday and how it worked practically real world.
It's more of how to put those techniques into practice.
Put them to work in the real world to really create change.
And that's what the summit's all about. How do you do this?
And it was actually done. So you actually a case study. You know.
So it'll also give people hope, but then they can take that and go back to their local organizations or cities or counties, wherever they are, and use those principles. It's the proof of the principles we talk about work.
And if we can do it here, they can do it there.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's vitally important. So it's Friday and Saturday.
Friday and Saturday.
So give us the quick overview.
It's an exceptional representation of what you can do. It gets down to the individual. The individual makes the change. Individual takes that first step to create a network. And here you'll learn how to do that kind of stuff. I really want to say one of the reasons why this is so important, I want to use a real life situation.
Okay.
Is last fall, a transsexual enrolled out at Southwest Texas Junior College in Uvalde, Texas. And she was denied housing, and she was told there was only one restroom on the entire campus that she was allowed to use.
Oh, my God.
And so this is why it's so important that we need to get out there, and we need to create this change.
Creating change. Give us the email address again.
txtgsummit@gmail.com.
And we've been talking to Josephine Titsworth, the organizer of the summit, and it's this coming Friday and Saturday. If you want to see change in your own life and in your own community, you need to be there. This is Queer Voices.
Thank you.
I'm Sarah. Sarah Sweeney.
And I'm Vosh Bodie.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending August 6th, 2011. The Kampala office of one of Uganda's major LGBT rights groups, Freedom and Rome Uganda, was broken into and vandalized on the evening of July 30th. Group leader Kasha Jacqueline Nabagasera said that five computers were stolen, including documents containing membership lists. Two printers, a server, and a microwave were also taken. Nabagasera said it was fortunate that no one was in the office at the time, but that the theft of the membership lists in particular has many LGBT people there on edge. The exact location of the office is kept secret, according to the UK's Pink Paper, because of fears of harassment or attack. Nabagasera debated the lead author of Uganda's proposed Kill the Gays Bill, MP David Bahati, on Voice of America television earlier this year. That bill would add even harsher penalties than existing law imposes for anyone convicted of engaging in private, consensual adult, same-gender sex, including the death penalty for repeat offenders and jail time for any citizen who fails to report a suspected gay person to the authorities. Nabagasera says she's had death threats, which have forced her to move from house to house as a result of her high-profile activism. Freedom and Rome Uganda had previously announced the launch of an anti-hate campaign, which Nabagasera said would proceed as planned. A community meeting was scheduled to take place this week in the burgled office. Police have reportedly not even visited the crime scene yet to begin an investigation.
Ireland's most prominent openly gay politician, Senator David Norris, has ended his campaign for the presidency following news reports that he sought clemency in 1997 for an ex-partner, Ezra Nawi, who had been jailed in Israel for the rape of a 15-year-old Palestinian boy. Norris was considered the frontrunner in the November election for Ireland's next ceremonial president and could have become the world's first openly gay head of state. There is one lesbian in such a position, Iceland's Prime Minister Jóhanna Sigurðardóttir. But key supporters began distancing themselves from Norris, and he told a Dublin news conference this week that he was quitting the race. I deeply regret the controversy concerning my former partner of 25 years ago, Ezra Yitzhak Nawi, he said. I do not regret supporting and seeking clemency for a friend, he continued, but I do regret giving the impression that I did not have significant compassion for the victim of Ezra's crime. Yes, his actions were terrible, but my motivation to write the letter was out of love and concern. It is very sad that in trying to help a person I loved dearly, I made a human error. Norris noted, however, that it is now possible for a gay person to be seen as a viable candidate for the highest office in the land. I would have loved to have had the opportunity as President of Ireland to extend that to the service of the entire people, but that is no longer possible.
Elsewhere, and in a national first, the next Australian census will count same-gender couples who've legally wed abroad. The National Marriage Act, however, bans civil marriage for gay and lesbian Australians in their home country. They can't even get married in all countries where it's legal if the federal government refuses to issue them the certificate of non-impediment to marriage that some nations require of foreign couples. Nonetheless, thousands of lesbian and gay couples have managed to get married overseas. Many married in Canada, which does not require a non-impediment certificate. Other couples have acquired a certificate to marry elsewhere, from their state government rather than the federal government. The new figures gathered during census night on August 9th will be made public next July.
Meanwhile, the American Psychological Association, the world's largest such organization, has called for state and federal officials to lift barriers to civil marriage equality. Its 157-member policy-making body voted unanimously at the group's annual conference in Washington, D.C. this week to support full marriage equality for same-sex couples. The resolution cited evidence that denying marriage to gay and lesbian couples may have negative effects on their psychological well-being. The resolution also said there was emerging evidence to suggest that statewide campaigns to deny marriage to same-gender couples are also a significant source of stress to the lesbian, gay, and bisexual residents of those states. Sociologist W. Bradford Wilcox, director of the National Marriage Project at the University of Virginia, Charlottesville, told USA Today that his board is divided on the issue. But he joined other analysts to call the American Psychological Association resolution significant for the ongoing public policy and legal battles in Washington and around the states. The 154,000-member APA has filed Friend of the Court briefs supporting marriage equality in 11 cases since 2004. It announced its formal opposition to reparative therapy, which claims to be able to heterosexualize gays and lesbians in 2009.
The Suquamish Tribal Council in the U.S. state of Washington voted unanimously this week to extend marriage rights to same-gender couples on its reservation near Seattle, the city name for the great chief who led that tribe in the late 1700s. Since same-gender marriage is not recognized by the federal government or elsewhere in Washington state, the law's effect is primarily limited to the reservation, which has about 1,000 enrolled members and is located on the shores of the Puget Sound. Couples must be at least 18 years old, and at least one of them must be enrolled in the tribe. Married lesbian and gay couples who leave Suquamish land, however, become legally single in all but a handful of jurisdictions that recognize their marriage. The Coquille tribe in Coos Bay, Oregon, became the first to open marriage to same-gender couples in 2009. Several other tribes are considering the move, but efforts to enact marriage equality in the nation's largest tribe, the Navajo, were turned back in 2006. Washington state does grant nearly all spousal rights to gay and lesbian couples through domestic partnerships, but denies them full marriage equality.
In other news, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control released new statistics on HIV this week that showed the rate of infection remaining relatively stable from 2006 to 2009 at about 50,000 a year. CDC officials said that white men who have sex with men continue to make up the largest number of new HIV infections. But they sounded the alarm over the rates of infection among young, black, gay, and bisexual men, which increased 48% in those 3 years. They said the disparity may be due to the continuing stigma of homosexuality in the African American community. Young black men who have sex with men also report higher rates of other STDs, which officials said could facilitate transmission of HIV. The overall rate of HIV infections among African Americans is almost 8 times that of whites. Black American women are contracting HIV at rates 15 times that of white women. And while prevention programs have averted significant increases in new infections, a CDC spokesperson said, the large and growing number of people living with HIV infections means that more people can transmit the virus.
California officials have authorized anti-equality forces to begin collecting signatures for a voter referendum next June. It would overturn the Fair, Accurate, Inclusive, and Respectful Education Act, a new law that requires public schools in the state to teach about LGBT and physically challenged people's contributions to state and national history. Existing law already requires school districts to include materials that accurately portray the contributions of racially diverse groups. Attorney General Kamala Harris titled the proposal Referendum to overturn non-discrimination requirements for school instruction. Opposition forces must now collect a little under 505,000 valid signatures from registered California voters and turn them into county officials by October 12th to qualify the referendum for the ballot. In California, writes Lambda Legal's top lawyer John Davidson, a referendum is quite unlike an initiative. A referendum refers to the electorate whether the bill that passed the legislature and was signed by the governor should be enacted or not. The electorate votes yes to approve the bill and no to keep the bill from becoming law, all of which is sure to generate significant errors in voting. Davidson believes anti-equality forces will have to use paid signature gatherers to meet the relatively short time allotted to qualify the measure, which he said can cost more than $1 million. LGBT advocacy groups and allies, including the California Federation of Teachers and the California Nurses Association, have launched a decline to sign campaign to counter the petition efforts. First, our opponents wanted to ban love, so they invented Prop 8, said Rick Jacobs of the Courage campaign. Now they want to use the same fear tactics to prevent California high school students from learning history.
And finally, U.S. country music superstar Dolly Parton personally apologized this week for an anti-lesbian incident at her Tennessee theme park, Dollywood. When Olivier Odom and her wife Jennifer Tippin tried to enter the park, Odom was asked to turn her t-shirt inside out because it said, "Marriage is so gay." Odom said that when she asked why, a park employee told her it was to avoid offending other visitors and that Dollywood is a family park. After the incident drew national attention, Parton herself issued a statement apologizing for the treatment of Odom and her wife. "I am truly sorry for the hurt or embarrassment regarding the gay and lesbian t-shirt incident at Dollywood Splash Country recently." Parton said, "Everyone knows of my personal support for the gay and lesbian community. Dollywood is a family park, and all families are welcome." Sure, why can't they get married? Parton said in 2009 when asked about opening marriage to lesbian and gay couples. They should suffer like the rest of us do.
That's News Wrap for the week ending August 6th, 2011, written by Greg Gordon, recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, and produced by Steve Pride. Read the text of this week's News Wrap online at thiswayout.org.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Vosh Bodhi.
And I'm Sarah Sweeney.
This is Queer Voices.
And this is Brian Levinka.
And Daniel Williams.
And in the studio, we have a friend of Queer Voices who's come on from time to time to talk about Houston Arch. But tonight he's talking about the John Kellett Foundation. And, of course, we have Brian Riedel in the studio. Welcome, Brian.
Welcome.
Thanks, Brian. Thanks, Dan. It's good to be back.
So, is this a new role for you? Or an expansion of what you used to do?
I've been working with the foundation for a few years. And the foundation itself, however, has been working in Houston for a long time. It's been here since 1992, and a lot of people may be familiar with it by the work that it's done supporting organizations like QFest, LHI, Hatch, a number of other organizations that we can talk about later tonight. But I'm glad you all allowed me to come out to tell the news about what's changing the foundation.
Well, it has to do with money, and I know that's important to everyone in our community at this time. So,
yeah. Access to funding for LGBT organizations has always been an issue, and one of the reasons that John Kellett made the foundation was to give a little bit more support to the organizations that form the backbone of our communities here in Houston. And so to broaden the reach of the foundation and to increase access to other organizations who may not have known about the foundation in the past, we've launched a website and changed the way that we do our grant application process.
So is it organizations that can apply, or is it people? Or
like most foundations, we fund only 501c3s.
Oh, okay. That's important.
It is possible, though, for organizations that do not have their own 501c3 status to collaborate with another as a fiduciary agent, rather like the Texas Transgender Non-Discrimination Summit, from whom we just heard. Mm-hmm. They have some similar arrangement with the community center, the Houston GLBT Community Center. And we like those kinds of relationships because it fosters organizations' growth over time.
Who has benefited in the past?
A large list of people. In fact, if we were to think about the history of Texas, the Kellett Foundation has been a significant role in those. The Texas Human Rights Foundation, some of you may remember, once upon a time was an organization in the 90s that was working to fight the sodomy law. The Texas Human Rights Foundation ended up supporting Linda Morales back when she did her lawsuit, right? Mm-hmm. So that ended up laying the foundation for the community of people who were aware and connected enough to then support the Lawrence versus Texas case, which clinched the deal.
Right.
So who was John Stephen Keller?
Well, not was.
Is.
Yeah.
Pardon me.
Yeah, John Kellett is our president.
I saw him like a few months ago. Pardon me.
No. He's doing very well, and he has been hard at work assembling and consolidating the board to make sure that the foundation continues for some time. Some of you may remember an article that was written about him in Outsmart magazine back in 2005 that profiled him. He's been a longtime resident of Houston. He used to work for Exxon. And, after the merger, I mean, we had some unhappiness with them. But that money that he earned, he is now turning around to good use, shall we say.
Yeah. Evil oil money now doing good.
Yeah. Evil money now making good in the world.
Making
Indeed. So some of you might actually know about QFest a little bit. We just came off of their 15th festival, their Queersignera.
Yeah, we had them on, I think, 2 weeks ago. Queersignera.
Yeah, we have been a sustaining funder of the festival from the beginning, back when it was held at Swamp, back when they were working with Diverse Works for office space. And we're very happy to see where they've gotten today. It's been a nice long road. They actually honored John Kellett for those years of support at the opening night of the festival back on, I think it was the 28th of July.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so you have community organizations. Do they focus on arts, or do they focus on, like, HIV healthcare, or is it kind of the whole range?
There's an interesting distinction that we make. The mission of the Kellett Foundation specifically does not include HIV, because that could very easily gobble up all of the money in the universe. It really could. And what we wanted to do was to focus our efforts on organizations that would not otherwise have access to funding. Mm. So there are structures like Ryan White, there are structures like sub-grants from other community organizations. The Kellett Foundation specifically focuses on arts, education, and cultural outreach to educate and entertain at the same time. It's kind of a head fake, right? Because how do you give someone a civil rights and social justice message and not have it come down like medicine?
Right.
So one of the things that...
That's the art form to do that.
Exactly. John was brilliant about this, because what he decided to do was to focus his effort on those organizations that were giving people something that they already wanted. A good night of entertainment, some social services, information, any of these kinds of things that people already were reaching for. But those organizations might not have had the wherewithal to do it. For example, way back when, the Gay Men's Chorus. What a perfect head fake. We're going to tell you a story about, here's an evening of song. Here's some entertainment. But while you're there, you see a whole bunch of different gay men who are out, proud, in public at Jones Hall.
Right.
Having a great time. And filling a room with not just LGBT community, but all of Houston. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of message that John wants to be able to support.
So it's kind of a bridge from the community to the greater community.
Absolutely. Know? That's one of the jobs of the foundation, is to help that bridge get formed.
So talk more about how things have changed for the grant. I mean, what's different specifically?
It's a good question. When the foundation was first started, it was a small group of people that John was cultivating to help him understand who deserved the money, right? So it was by invitation. It was a lot of talk, a lot of who met who. And that was really good for the beginning time of the foundation, to get a few great projects started. But what we've realized over the last few years is that there's an ever-expanding set of organizations that could benefit from the money but don't know about the foundation. And so how to solve both of those problems? We don't know everybody. There's only six of us on the board at the moment, although we may grow in the future, depending. And the things that we do know do not include everybody. So let's make the process a little bit more open. So to do that, we've adopted a letter of inquiry system. It's real easy. You send in a one-page letter. All the information is on the website, which is very easy to remember. KellettFoundation.org.
Okay, so anyone that's listening now can go to the website and fill out the letter of inquiry about a grant.
It's not a fill-out form. It's a set of instructions
to do
a letter of inquiry. And then everyone's letters of inquiry, it's just one page. It's a very minimal amount of investment on your part as a grant applicant. Then once we see all these letters, we select the projects from those letters that we're like, yes, please give us a full application, and we'll send you that information then.
So what is the timeline for this this process?
We have an annual grant cycle, and we will keep giving out grants until the money for that year runs out. So it's a long, long cycle.
Well, since I've got you here, if my organization wants to submit one of these letters of inquiries, can you give me some hints on what you're looking for?
Everything we're looking for is on the website. Follow the directions, and you will probably be invited, if the project is worthy, for a full application.
So it's a test.
Follow the rules, right? That's one of the big things. I think really what we're looking for also are innovative ways to help the community do what it does better, that are concrete projects, not something kind of in the, oh, we'd like a little bit of extra money to fund someone who we already have as a salaried employee. So what might it look like? Here's some things we've funded in the past. Lesbian Health Initiative. For a long time, it was very difficult for women to get information that was timely and accurate about women's health issues if they were lesbians.
Right.
So over time, LHI has expanded, of course. I think you've had Liz James
on. Liz is fantastic.
Fantastic powerhouse. We're very pleased that she's at the helm of the organization now. So what they've done is they're wanting to continue this tradition that they had with the newsletter of putting timely information out. That newsletter we funded for a long time, for example. Q-Fest, specific screenings of films we funded in the past. The foundation has also funded things for Hatch, expanded access for the youth, for example. So these are the kinds of projects that get funded.
Expanded access?
There was a little bit of computer access. They've already gotten funding from the David Bonnet Foundation, but there was also a television that needed purchasing so they could watch films together.
So it could be very specific, like our organization needs this.
Right, and that is in fact the great reason for the kind of amount that we give. We tend to give around $1,000 at a time. Mm-hmm. We can go up to $2,000, maybe $2,500 in a pinch, it depends, but we like to cap at $2,000.
Right.
So another example that's really coherent, the history tent at the Pride Festival.
Oh.
Back when it first started, there was a need for an air-conditioned tent, because the objects that were going to be displayed need that kind of protection, especially from the Houston sweltering humid heat, right? Not to mention the people
I was going to say, the people in the going into the tent need the AC as well.
This year's best exhibit in the history tent was Ray Hill.
I think Ray might also have liked the fact that the Transgender Foundation of America was there, the Botts Collection was there, University of Houston, Rice University was there. And so that little bit of money to create that air conditioning allows so many organizations to benefit from it. That's, to answer your question in long form, Dan, the kind of thing the Kellett Foundation likes to do. It has a knock-on, add-on effect when it's done right.
And it's the best part of the festival, by far.
We are very glad to have been able to support the History Tent in the past and hope to see more of the History Tent in the future.
Now, how did you get involved with the Kellett Foundation?
John asked me to help out after a little while.
Mm-hmm.
We met a number of years ago, I want to say like 5 years ago, and he just reached out and said, "Hi, I'd like you to do this."
And so you worked your way up to executive director, I guess?
It was part of the foundation's need to kind of get things in a coherent form that does what John wants it to do. And he saw that there was a need for an executive director, and so the board asked me if I would step into that role.
And there's 6 members on the board?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And do you need volunteers, or is it kind of a self-governing type organization?
The 6 of us are handling the work pretty well right now. If, as we see with this expanded form of access, the number of grant applications rise, which we hope will be the case,
right.
We would be very much in the frame of mind of looking for additional people to serve on the board.
And I'm curious, because I always wonder what inspires people to go out and give away money. What led John to create the foundation?
I would say it was having means and seeing need. And this is always the story, right? When you have something at your disposal and you see a community that's given so much to you, how can you not give back to it? I think really it's more a question of how can you not do it? You know, earlier before we started the segment, we were talking about the need for people who are active in the community.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, Dan, you were saying that there's lots of people out there who could be doing stuff. The question is, are they? And that's really what I think John's trying to do through the foundation is to incentivize people to get involved,
mm-hmm.
to give them a reason by placing value on the things that we know matter by supporting it economically. So support Q-Fest. That helps Q-Fest grow and bring more people
bring
to it.
Bring more people in and get
support.
More exposure. And
right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly so.
And so how many applications have you had so far? And how many are you looking for?
Well, we're just now getting the word out about the new way of doing things. And as the applications trickle in, we'll see when things top out. We've got a good number in hand right now that we'll be considering. We meet on a quarterly basis. That might help people see how things are paced.
Remind me again where I need to go to fill out that information?
There you go. The foundation's website is kellettfoundation.org. That's K-E-L-L-E-T foundation.org.
Is there anything else you want our listeners to know about, Brian?
The more people who get together and make ideas come down on paper, the more those ideas become real. Apply, apply, apply.
Absolutely. Well, we've been talking to Brian Riedel about the Kellett Foundation grants and the revamp process for this year. So, listeners of Queer Voices, please apply and get the money and get these organizations going.
This is Queer Voices.
Thank you.
You like girls, but you don't understand all those girls and the curves in this world. You go down.
That was the medley that ends Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, performed there by the Broadway show cast and recorded earlier this year. And before that, Which Way Do You Go? By Paxton, and that's from the album of the same name, released in 1997.
From the Sharptown High School Broadcasting Program. KPFT has just launched a new paperless system at kpft.org. Now, you can submit public service announcements, open journal proposals, and more through the station website, kpft.org. Going paperless is better for the environment and means your submissions arrive faster to KPFT offices. Do you have a nonprofit community event to promote? Do you have an idea for a program or want to host an open journal? Then visit kpft.org now to submit your application. While there, you can make a pledge online and support the great programming you love. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston.
Writers in the Schools employs professional writers who teach long-term creative writing workshops in schools, hospitals, homeless shelters, and other community centers in the Houston area, reaching over 15,000 students annually. By teaching children how to write stories, essays, and poems, Writers in the Schools offers them a creative outlet that will enrich their lives academically and emotionally. To learn more about Writers in the Schools, please call 713-523-3877 or visit www.writersintheschools.org.
This is KPFT Houston.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Valinsky and the entire Queer Voices crew.
Hey! Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy. This way.
I wanted to start a series of honoring some of the icons in this community. One of the things I think we forget that the younger generation may not realize is some of the trailblazers that, under very tough circumstances, have built this community. And not to say that we always got along, because we didn't. We sometimes fought. We fought and fought. But Marion Coleman's here. And I wanted to have her, and I know she's been reluctant on this.
Very.
Because she's, even though she's a public figure, she's very private in her life. Marion Coleman has been part of this community since the day, way before I moved here. Marion, you came from Massachusetts.
Cape Cod.
Cape Cod, no less.
And I was born in Provincetown.
Yes, I saw that on your bio.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me about you know, your early life. I mean, it was so much more difficult to be part of this community. And you're not shy about your age, right?
No, I'm not. I'm 75.
And you look fabulous.
Thank you, Connor.
You can't see it on the radio, but you are absolutely fabulous.
Thank you. How? Is that Portuguese blood, okay?
Yes, yes. The Mystic Pizza movie.
Right, yes.
Growing up, and when did you leave Massachusetts?
In 1957.
And you came here?
Yes.
What was the connection? What brought you here?
Well, I had a platonic marriage, and he shared with me that there were two places he thought that we should move to, two cities. One was Atlanta, Georgia, and one was Houston, Texas. He felt those were the cities that were going to be tremendous in promoting businesses and diversified investments. So he told me to choose, and so I chose Houston. It just sounded so exciting to me.
You had no idea.
I had no clue.
And this is not when people were able to get on a plane real easily and travel.
Oh, absolutely.
Right.
Yeah, when I got on that Piper Cub in Provincetown to fly to Boston, I was scared to death. But it was a very good move. But at the same time, I didn't want to leave the Cape and my family.
And you and all the people. So when did you start realizing who you were?
Well, Jim was very kind. He pushed me in many directions, because when I was a little girl, I used to have a paper out. I had it for 4 years, and I went 10 miles every single day, and I delivered to the door. You know, you didn't throw papers in those days, and you collected every Saturday, so through all the four seasons. And so that was, and he saw me in those days delivering papers. And then I went to work for him in a lab, and then I went to work in a restaurant to help support, after my dad died, to support my mom and my sister and brother. And so I took a waitress job, I took a bakery job early in the morning, then my paper out, and he saw the energy that I had. And then he'd come to the restaurant every evening, and he'd eat there, and he'd always leave me a $5 tip. So that's how I met Jim, and he just wanted to see me succeed, and he knew that I had lost my dad, so he basically became a father figure to me, and he really pushed me to better myself and to try to do things a little bit differently than I would have on the Cape.
And what was it like coming to Houston?
Scary. In fact, we lived in the Montague Hotel. That's when that hotel was just, now I'm really dating myself here, but that was a hotel that was the hotel in 57. And so we stayed there for about a year. And then we moved to the city of Pasadena. In fact, that tall building is one of Jim's projects that he was involved in. And he purchased 24 apartments and said, here, this is yours. You run it. You run it. And see what you can do with it. So I had to manage and run 24 units called Jay's Apartments in Pasadena. That was something else. But I had fun.
And this was a very different city back then, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. Yeah, it was. It was very unionized at that time. And that's when I became involved in politics, too, was in the city of Pasadena, because the woman that was the postmistress, was her husband was appointed by Dwight Eisenhower, and so she asked me if I would take over the leadership in the party, and then Senior Bush became area chairman of the Harris County Republican Party, and then I got involved in the political aspect of it. So,
and how did you start getting involved in our community?
Well,
what was our community back then?
Nothing much.
Nothing, right.
Not really, which was kind of sad. I had a printing company that I started in 1970, and the very first community project that I did was the Houston Rape Coalition for Women. I got involved in the Women's Center, and I also got involved with Point Blank Times, the newspaper. So I did all the newspapers, the newsletters for the Rape Coalition and for Point Blank Times. And it was a gay woman's magazine.
And the printing business was completely different, wasn't
it? Oh, I had a most difficult time. I actually had, when I visited advertising firms, they actually asked me to leave because they didn't think that a woman could do any printing.
Really?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
But eventually, over a period of about 5 years, they started coming to me because of the quality work that I produced. So
and,
I turned around.
You know, we're so into this computer world. It wasn't like that back then.
No,
I mean, there were no computers in the printing business.
No,
how was it done? I mean, it was...
Well, in those days, we did artwork. You know, you had the letterpress down, and of course you had the hot type that you had to go to a place to have the hot type done. Then you had galley proofs. And then you had to have shooting negatives of the copy of the artwork, and then you'd had to burn plates, and then you had to put it on the press with a blanket. It was pretty exciting because I never done anything like that before.
In a sense, doing any type of alternative newspaper was a real challenge.
Oh, it was a major challenge, yeah. But I was a quality printing company, and I wanted to remain small so I could have an individual connection with my clients, and I think that's why I was so successful in the quality of the work that we did, because we produced artwork and graphic design and printing,
right,
all under the same roof.
Wow.
Yeah.
And were you always on out West Alabama? Where did you
yes
how did you
36
find that
years.
Wow,
36 years I was in the printing business. And I also was rewarded with the Ben Franklin Award, which was one of the most prestigious awards, and the first woman in the Southwest to win that.
Wow.
In 1974, I think it was. I was in business in 1970, so.
And you were involved in the women's community, and then the gay community start growing?
Well, I was involved in the Now chapter.
Okay.
And then,
which at that time, this was all lesbians anyway, right?
Well,
I mean, that was a joke.
Yeah, that's a joke. There were some really wonderful women, you know, Poppy Nothka and Helen Cassidy and Nikki Von Hanshauer. So there were some really neat women that I worked with, but there were a lot of gay women, that's for sure.
And you saw basically the birth of the GPC at that time, Gay Political Caucus.
Yes, I did.
And you were involved in that?
Yes, I became vice president.
And
along with you?
Well, I was involved in a much smaller role back then.
Not really, Jack.
how was that? And you were trying to bring a different perspective.
Well, Larry Bonnaries was the president at that time, and because I have a Jeffersonian philosophy, and therefore that, to me, was under the umbrella of the Republican Party, he wanted to bridge, because most of the people that belonged to the caucus were Democrats.
And many of the other political organizations of the gay community around the country were pretty much Democrat organizations.
Oh,
Democratic.
Very much so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say 99.5%, yeah. For sure. But he wanted to bridge the gap and bring us together and be able to listen to how we felt and what we could do to better our community and working together.
I think there was also the perspective of not having all your eggs in one basket.
Exactly. Oh, yes. Yeah.
And that way, if we were able to open up, because the Republican Party isn't like it is today.
That's true.
And there's a lot of Republicans who don't really sort of are representative by the tea baggers or the Rush Limbaughs.
That's correct.
I mean, my parents weren't that way.
Right. Well, I'm I guess if you were to classify me, I'd probably be a Rockefeller Republican.
Right.
Yeah, for sure.
And basically that was privacy.
Uh-huh.
You know, people have a right to...
Exactly. Individual rights. No government control. Yeah, for sure.
Well, beyond that, you also got involved in a number of nonprofit organizations.
Yes.
And Montrose Counseling Center was one that you were...
Founding member.
An incredible... how it's... you know, to me, it's like it's easy to start an organization. It's harder to keep it going.
Right.
And look where it is today.
Right. Well, we had some wonderful board members. I was so fortunate to be on so many boards or asked to. And I guess basically to be up front, I was basically sometimes the token woman because I was mostly out there and I was gay. And, you know, so, well, Marion, let's ask Marion. So, and I stepped into that and I was proud to do that. But I learned a lot and it was very rewarding to me to sit with people and have a goal to help this community in every aspect that I served, and we did it. And there were some difficult times financially and trying to get what we needed to share with the community about what the community was about, and these organizations were available and were there to help everyone.
You know, one of the things we used to say that was like basically five activists in the community, and we just traded hats for all these different organizations.
Yes.
And when we went to meetings, we'd meet the same people because we're basically,
exactly. Mm-hmm.
And you probably more so than me. I also remember this story, and I may be fantasizing more than the truth, but maybe you can confirm this, that Larry Bonnery's probably went to a quality printer, somebody probably like you, when the GPC with the red dot in it, and he had the names of the board members printed on the left side. And when he presented it to the board members, half of them said, "You cannot use this because my name is on there." And that's where we were back then.
That's right.
There are so many
people
in this community that wanted to be involved and wanted to be active, but they couldn't do it publicly. You were out there.
That's right. Yes, we had to reprint that letterhead. I had to reprint it, and it was kind of neat, the design. I can't remember who did the design for us. I think it was Randy Woolman, if I remember correctly. And when he came to me and he gave me that artwork, and there was that dot, and I said, you know, this is two color, and this is close registration. He said, yes, and you're the only one that can do it. And then we had to redo it because we had to remove the names. And so we could only list the names of people that agreed, but there were very few that would that we could print.
Wow.
Yeah, my name was on there, yeah, for sure. I had nothing really to lose. You know, I believed in what I believed in. And I lost a lot of business because of my connection with GPC.
Interesting.
Yes.
So those organizations were... Somebody also told me the story that a lot of nonprofits that started back in those days would never use the word gay or lesbian in it because it would be a target by the IRS. So they had to use Human Rights, Montrose Counseling Center, you know, Montrose Clinic.
Yeah, I served on those boards, and that's absolutely correct.
Wow, that's pretty interesting.
Yes, absolutely. Shocking.
And certainly you were... very active in the community when AIDS start appearing.
Yes.
And those of us who do remember, it was the women's part of our community who really, probably even more so than some of us, stood up for us.
Absolutely, Jack.
Whether it was, and I don't mean to be putting words in your mouth, and go ahead.
No, go ahead.
The fact is that giving blood.
Yes.
Helping raise money.
Yes.
I mean, certainly the drag queens did a lot, but the women's community was there with us. They didn't run away from us.
No, they did not. And what was so neat about this is I also had a place called Kindred Spirits. It's a community. I always call it a community bar. And when I also hired men as well as I did women. And when the crisis hit and some of our men became sick and were living with AIDS, the support was just incredible. And then when I had a fella come and say, you know, Marion, there's a need for blood for men. Is there anything you can do? And I said, yes, there is. So we put together a blood drive at Kindred Spirits, and we did it in 2 weekends, and we had over 400 women donate blood.
Wow.
Yeah, it was incredible. But what was so sad about that at that time was when the Red Cross found out that it was done in the gay bar, they stopped it. So we decided that we'd go individually every 8 weeks to donate blood. And many women did that for a long time.
Wow.
Yeah.
So Kindred Spirits, and you were in two different locations. I mean,
yes.
You had one bar in Buffalo Speedway.
Yes.
And then moved out to Richmond just inside the Loop.
Exactly, right.
What was probably very memorable about your bar was that so many of the gay bars, the men's bars, were, especially in the beginning, were in parts of town that were hidden. The bars were hidden. The signs were hidden. And you sort of had a nice sign, well-lit bar. And you were tough also. You made sure that it was run as a professional business, that things that weren't supposed to be happening in bars didn't happen there.
The women in this community deserved that. They deserved a place where they could come and feel secure, that they were cared about. And I had a lot of young people come in that I knew were underage, but as long as they presented something that I could accept as an ID, I'd rather have them in our place than somewhere else, because I knew we could protect them. And we were never cited for any violation by any organization, the police department, the health department, TABC. In fact, the police officers that we used to hire, when they'd come up, these various organizations said, well, we're in there, we're going to find something. They said, well, let me bet you some money. And so at the end, when they would come, well, we didn't find anything. So, you know, but we did have a good record.
You also had your parking lots patrolled and lit.
Yes, yes.
So that it was
safe.
We had
security outside and inside.
And I certainly remember being there at times when the bar wasn't open, doing mail outs.
Yes.
Doing community stuff, mm-hmm. because we didn't have other places to do that. We didn't have a community center.
All right. Well, Jack, you had the first press conference there where we invited the media at Kindred Spirits, and you were dealing with that, and you said to me, wow, this is really nice that we can sit here in a nice place and we can greet the media and share with them the things that we want to do and how we do it.
And one of the reasons we did that press conference, and I think Larry had a lot to say about it too, was that we wanted some of the leaders of the other community organizations to
yes.
be able to share
right.
and to learn what it is to deal with the community.
Exactly.
And
we did that very well.
Yes, yes.
It was incredible.
Even if the cameras were gone by that time, they were still up there, experience what it was like to be behind the podium.
Right.
And be able to talk about that. Yeah. What year were you Grand Marshal?
What year? 1982.
1982. That was, yes.
Yes.
And how did that feel?
I was really surprised, to tell you the truth. I didn't see that I wasn't around that long, to tell you the truth. And I think I only had Kindred Spirits. I only had Kindred Spirits in 1980, right? 1980. Okay. So I only had Kindred Spirits for 2 years. But we made such an impression, I think, on the community as a whole. I think that that was their way of thanking us by choosing myself to represent us. I think that's basically how that happened.
We're going to take a little break now, and we're going to continue our conversation with Marion Coleman. You're listening to Queer Voices.
Hey, 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 hey. Your lipstick stains on the front lobe of my left side brains. I knew I wouldn't forget you, and so I went and let you blow. Tonight, hey, 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 hey.
a game show of love connection we can't deny. I'm so obsessed. My heart is bound to beat right out my untrimmed chest. I believe in you like a virgin, you're Madonna.
Tyler Robinson from a single recorded this year, the name of the track, Hey Soul Sister. This is Queer Voices.
Marion, we're talking to Marion Coleman about her long and involved history, deep involvement in history. And one of the things she says during the song was that we're a community. And I absolutely agree with you. We were a community that we did. We fought, and you and I fought many times.
Yes, that's true.
But the reality is that we fought, but then we all tried to, we had different opinions on things. But you're saying that a lot of things that happened was because people did work together.
Yes, that's very, very true.
The building of the organizations, the Montrose Clinic, the Montrose Counseling Center, which was Legacy Now, the AIDS Foundation.
The switchboard.
That has been luckily given new life under the Montrose Counseling Center as Hatches.
Right.
And I remember one of the things Larry Bonnery said, he had one of the events in Pride was the youth night or whatever, but that would never get on the official calendar because would say we were recruiting.
Right.
Now it has the organization that helps the youth out is under the Montrose Counseling Center.
That's correct.
And I once had the pleasure of speaking there, but the controls that they put on that so that there was never one adult with the kids. There was multiple adults.
Yes.
There were professionals, Ann Robinson of the Counseling Center, who's been there since almost the beginning, who has done incredible work there. And I was only there a short time working for them. But how she kept that separation, like people talk about the newspaper, there's advertising and there's editorial.
Right.
Well, she kept that professional side so locked down from people who are not the professionals who are doing the other things.
That's correct.
It's absolutely incredible.
Listen, I've been around a lot of executive directors in my time, and I have to tell you, she's one of the finest executive directors I've ever had the pleasure of working with. I mean, she doesn't even like to pay a penny for a pencil. I mean, she's just totally incredible, and she's I see that her heart and her focus is strictly for the gay and lesbian community, period. And their mission statement remains the same. It's like some of the organizations now, they don't use the word gay, lesbian, transgender. it's not there, and they don't want to use it because, oh, we're not going to get the money, we're not going to get the grants, we're not going to get this, and blah, blah, blah. Well, Anne did it. She was successful. We still have the gay flag. We still have gay, lesbian, transgender, I'm bisexual. It's still in our mission statement, and it's in the building. And she's been very strong about that, that's why we're there, and she's not going to change it. And I admire that, and I respect that so much. That's why I'm still involved with the Counseling Center. So, and I give Anne a lot of credit for that.
Absolutely.
She didn't bow down.
And you've seen that grow from that little space over at 900 Lovett.
Yes, we had two rooms when
right.
we first started.
Right, and funding must have been almost impossible. In fact, I'm guessing it was probably all local funding at the beginning, almost?
Almost, yes. And then we almost had to close our doors, and that's when I had to out myself to my banker. We needed some funding, and so I went ahead and we got the loan and got it paid back, and I outed myself to my banker, and I didn't know how he would react to that, but that's why I was there. And he said, "Marion, if you believe in this, I believe in it." And we received the money, but we were very close to closing the doors.
Wow.
And of course you had Bill Scott. I mean, what can you say about Bill Scott and John?
Bill Scott was one of the first people to come on KPFT or any radio station in the country and talk about AIDS.
Yes.
And talk about what it was like, and use the words that we used in the community. I had to get lawyers to look over. They said, "You can't say it, but the guests can say it."
Exactly.
I was so proud.
Person, and it was those people that are responsible for the Counseling Center with its start and what they've accomplished. Those are the goals that they set. I only wish they were here to see
right.
their success today. You know,
right.
this is like in all of our organizations. It takes all of us to do what we're doing. It's not one person or two people. It's all of us. Like, take Kindred Spirits, for instance. You know, we were a nightclub at one time, and we were very devoted to the women, but we also brought men and women together. And for now, we're a foundation. Kindred Spirits is a foundation, and we have wonderful board members. It's not me that does all of this. It's all of us together, and we have such great board members, and I've had the pleasure of working and the honor of working with so many gifted, talented people. In fact, sitting to my left here is Nancy Ford, and she was part of our community with Kindred Spirits. I heard the interview you did with her not long ago. The one thing she didn't share with you was the very first talent show that Kindred Spirits put
Marion,
on for women.
Here we go.
She won. Unanimously, and she won the Friday night talent night, and she was exceptional, and she drew the crowds. And so our musical festival, we started that was due to Nancy.
Well, I'll tell you, it was certainly an honor and a pleasure to work there, but the whole point was that this Kindred Spirits was open at such an integral time, I think, in our gay and lesbian history. Largely, not entirely, but largely because of the AIDS crisis and the number of people, women and men, but specifically I'm speaking for the women now, being a woman, being a lesbian. Kindred Spirits played such an amazing role in our lives. It changed so many of our lives. It, not just mine, because I was performing there and you know, one of my very first, well, certainly my very first gig at a gay bar, or a gay club. But it just, Kindred Spirits really showed us that we could come together and not be ashamed. We didn't have to go into a dingy, dank, dark bar and have our emotions be reflected as such. We could go into this clean, airy, well-lit, incredibly huge sign over Loop 610 bar that beckoned us into Kindred Spirits, and we could be proud. We could bring our families. We could feel no shame. And I think it really, really made an absolute, you know, amazing difference, certainly in my life and in the lives of every woman who walked through there. And it's still reflected in our current parties. You see the women who were at the Kindred Spirits come in, and they, every one of them share their
You're
stories.
You're absolutely right. If you've seen the recent PBS special called Stonewall,
I have.
Or the beginning part of the film Milk, where they actually showed people being pulled out of bars, being thrown in the paddy wagons, being beat up, taken, and their names put in the paper. We, how we didn't have all need the Montrose Counseling Center or something like that is incredible.
Right. And Mary, if I can interject this, Marion will not tell you this, but she was one of those people who got beat up and stones thrown at her in the Pride Parade when she was the Grand Marshal. I know you're looking at me, but it's you know, people need to know this, that our history as recently as this period of time, as recently as just 30 years ago, this kind of violence was still happening to our leaders, and I don't know, to me, making it all the more brave and exceptional.
So when you and I got to be Grand Marshal, we didn't have that happen to
us. Yeah, all we had to do was smile and wave.
Right.
That's all we had to do.
We had the float.
We had the float. We had the protection. We had it all.
Yeah. Andy and I were stoned when we turned from Shepherd on to Westheimer.
Andy Mills,
but we did not want to say anything. We just were quiet about it. I shared that with Nancy. I think she's the only one I shared that with.
Yeah, you don't know what else I might say here behind the microphone, do you, Marion
Oh,
Coleman?
My goodness.
No, I won't. It's just, like I said, she won't tell you, but the difference she's made in thousands of people's lives is just, you know, it's a trickle-down thing, because the people that you have affected, Marion, and influenced, pass it on. They pay it forward, and it's a legacy that will live for a long time, I believe, through kindred spirits and, you know, the people that whose lives you've changed.
Yeah, Nancy's also part of our foundation.
How did Kindred Spirits become a foundation?
Well, over the years, since we closed Kindred Spirits, everywhere I go, and I get phone calls and letters throughout the years asking me to reopen Kindred Spirits. And, of course, I can't do that. And I'm in a relationship.
Well, your partner would kill you for one thing.
That's for sure. And she did say that to me several times. And
people don't realize, and my parents owned a little mom-and-pop bar, how tough it is to run a bar.
It's very difficult.
And certain people can't run a bar because of addiction problems. It kills your nightlife. I mean, your home life.
Right.
It's a tough, tough thing to do.
Right.
And I'm just talking about a mom and pop bar, let alone.
It was difficult, but Jack, when you know that you're there to help other people find themselves and to be a part of each other's lives and to support each other, it becomes very easy, and it did for me. There were times when I got beaten up and, you know, and slapped and punched and verbally abused because I would cut people off. We had a cutoff policy, and it was just certain things, no drugs. And it was difficult at times. And I saw friends that I didn't realize that had an alcohol problem, and I wouldn't let them drink. And so that was a problem, but that's minor compared to what we were there to do, and that was very important to us. So I think that that's far more important, that we were there helping each other and doing whatever we could do. And that's the other thing. We were sort of a community bar where we had literature out about the counseling center, about GPC. I guess it's called GLPC. What is it called now?
The caucus. BT, political caucus,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, right. So, and the clinic and so forth. And so that we could pass on that information.
And the publications that used to come out weekly.
Yes.
Because we didn't have an internet back
right.
then.
And we had theater there at a kid's.
Yeah, Joe Watts.
Joe Watts, director. He was just fabulous. Randy Jobe performed there several times. We had a lot of dignitaries come in. Gloria Steinem visited our bar. Martina Navratilova. And also, we had Halloween parties where we'd have public figures come in, like Kathy Whitmire and George Grenius and Deborah Danberg, Ann Wheeler. Do you remember Ann?
I absolutely do. Yes.
So Nikki Van Hightower.
As you look back at, you know, where we came from to where we are now, what do you see? Where do you see our community? Where do you see us going from now?
Oh, there's no stopping us. I mean, I think we're on the right track of presenting ourselves professionally and doing what we're doing in a positive way. I've never been a really negative, angry person because that's not me, and I can't wave a flag. If I'm out there just being myself and trying to be a part of the community and all of us just pulling ourselves together, working toward the goal of being a part of each other's lives, understanding who we are and what we do and respect that, there isn't anything that we can't accomplish. I think we've come a long way. We still have a long ways to go. But as long as we have love in our hearts.
Did you envision that we would have groups at companies? We have employee groups envision that?
Oh, Jack, how can you say we didn't with all the people that we've worked with over the years? Their heart and in their soul and what we were doing, and they were there night and day with all of these ideas. Absolutely, Jack. Absolutely. I mean, you've been with people like Larry Bonneries was one of your mentors.
Yes.
And look what he was able to do in a short time with just a very few of us.
I have to throw this in. You've told me before that one of your favorite songs is John Lennon's Imagine.
Yes.
And that's kind of what you just said.
Right.
You know, you did imagine it, and certainly a lot of other people apparently did too. And if you don't imagine it, no, it'll never happen. But
right.
Apparently you saw it.
Well, we all do.
You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one.
Well, Mary, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you here.
Well, thank you, Jack.
I hope I put you at ease.
Yes, you did. Thank you. It's not my cup of tea.
Yeah. Well, people need to know where we came from and the people behind where we came from.
Yes, but Jack,
that pushed us forward.
Yeah, but at the same time, I'm part of it. I was very fortunate with the people that I was surrounded by. They gave me so much, and that's what I'm trying to return.
Marion, thank you very much.
God
Nancy
bless you,
Ford,
Jack.
Thank you for my joining pleasure. Us. You're listening to Queer Voices.
It's hard to want an out actor who's never been in. We'll pull the wig off Robert Downey Jr.'s former cellmate later in the program. Diane Torr's Man for a Day workshops have made the bisexual gender transformation performance artist known around the world. You may have heard about the book she co-authored with Stephen J. Bottoms last year entitled Sex, Drag, and Male Roles, but you may not know about the feature film on her set for release in September. Torr told her transforming story to This Way Out correspondent Dixie Trichel.
Diane, as a pioneer in the drag king movement and gender transformation workshops that you do, tell me how you got interested in this and how it began.
I grew up in Scotland, in Aberdeen. I was actually born in Canada, but my parents are British. I spent my childhood in Scotland, and then I went to art school in England, Dartington College of Arts, and then in 1976 I moved to New York. And I was a feminist activist. I was very involved with feminism, but I was also a dancer, and I worked for Majority Report, which was a feminist newspaper that was operating in New York at that time in Sheridan Square, actually. And I guess the idea of working in gender is something to do with an idea about identity and who am I, or what am I, or where am I. And it all has to do with a kind of an analysis that I've developed through being a feminist activist, but also through a physical experience. I think, as we all know, men get treated very differently from women, and this became very clear to me in the exhibitions I started making where I was performing as a man and I started going out publicly as a man, and that's when the difference became very clear to me. But in terms of the cabaret circuit, it was really Shelley Mars and myself who were doing stuff in the early 80s and in drag and performing in drag. I became known as somebody who would do this, to do these transformations. And in 1989, Annie Sprinkle contacted me because she was doing a photo shoot with a female-to-male transsexual, Johnny Science, and she asked me if I would be willing to do a photo shoot where I was a woman and then transformed and was a man, because she wanted some photos to illustrate the article. And that was the first time that I really had facial hair, because before that I relied very much on the physicality or my ability to create kind of way of moving that could be considered masculine, and so that when I went out as a man, began, I really had a sense of projecting, if you like, projecting my energy into the world and being able to take up space. So when I went out with makeup on, I had no idea that I was going to pass. And I went to an opening at the Whitney Museum, and I thought it would just be fun, and I would see my friends, and it would be a laugh. And actually, nobody recognized me, and it was very strange, you know, for me. And I saw these friends, and I waved at them, and they just ignored me or turned away from me. And so I tried to talk to them, and they just turned their backs, like, you know, who are you? You know, go away. So I realized that I was incognito, and I thought, well, everybody thinks I'm a man. And I also noticed at that moment that, although it was very crowded, it was the Whitney Biennial in 89, April 89, and people actually made way for me. And that never happens as a woman, that people actually step aside and that you have to stay. At that point, I thought, well, this could be such a good experience if women have this opportunity to experience the kind of privilege and entitlement that men have.
Tell me about your Man for a Day workshop.
Well, the Man for a Day workshop is usually a minimum of 2 days and longer if possible, but within that workshop there's the possibility for women to have the experience of taking on a character or taking on the role as a man and transforming. And part of the transformation, it's kind of like an acting course, if you like, but really it's something that anybody can do. And we always go out publicly, and I do a whole training with women. And I've been doing this since 1990, and I never imagined when I started that it would still be, you know, there would still be an appeal. But of course, there are new generations coming along, and people have never heard about it. And so the invitations continue. Like, I just came back from Brazil, and workshops have taken place in other places all through Europe and Istanbul, Delhi, in places where, you know, women very often don't have any rights or very little. So it was quite a huge transformation for a lot of the women.
Diane, talk a little bit about your most recent book, Sex, Drag, and Male Roles, Investigating Gender as Performance.
The book I co-wrote with Stephen Bottom. It's really a collaboration in which performance artist and critic or scholar are put together, and in this case we collaborated and we worked together. He focused more on a theater history of women in breeches roles, women in vaudeville, all history of women performing in drag. And for me, you know, it's an enormous achievement because I've been trying to do this book for about 10 years, and finally I'm very happy with the results. It's about the possibility to be more, really. That's how I see it. And about expanding who you are. I mean, we have a limited role as women, and by incorporating the male role, we become greater, you know, and so gesture becomes a palette, and it shouldn't necessarily be defined by this is masculine, this is feminine, but that it's just there. It's human behavior. It's accessible. I think that younger people get this, and they're maybe questioning conformity to one role or another because we've all been conditioned to behave in particular ways.
I know you've done workshops in Berlin, and you have a new film coming out.
I'm working on a film, actually, with a Berlin filmmaker there called Katharina Peters, and it's just called Man for a Day. And the feature film will be coming out in September this year, and people should look out for it. You know, Germans are amazing. They take things to the nth degree. They say, okay, you have this concept of women transforming into men, and let's just see if this is going to work with any woman. And so I was given, I think, 12 women from all these different backgrounds, and there was one lesbian in the whole group. And there were black women, there were Turkish women as well. How are they going to, you know, deal with this? And how am I going to deal with them and working with them in terms of gender transformation? I think it's going to be quite an interesting film.
The upcoming movie about Diane Torr is called Man for a Day, and the title of her book is Sex, Drag, and Male Roles, Investigating Gender as Performance. She was interviewed by Dixie Trichel.
Extra, extra, read all about it, extra.
A new This Way Out update has been posted on our website. For recent programming information and behind-the-scenes news about your favorite international LGBT radio show, log on to www.thiswayout.org.
Chattanooga.
the Tennessee-born Emmy winner Leslie Jordan packs a load of talent and personality into his 4'11" frame. His prominent roles on TV shows like Will and Grace, Sordid Lives, Ally McBeal, and Star Trek Voyager have made him a familiar face in homes worldwide. But he's also an accomplished stage actor and playwright. Jordan's latest is an autobiographical one-man show entitled My Trip Down the Pink Carpet. He visited with Rosie Wilby on her Resonance FM Out in South London show during the West End run of the play earlier this year.
I think it's a wonderful time to be an openly gay actor right now. I have sort of painted myself into a corner because I only get offered very effete, sort of screaming queen roles.
Yes.
And that's all right. You know, I do that. I do that well. But I got a call not too long ago for a... I've never in 30 years in the business had an offer. You know, you hear these people, I audition, you know, I beg, I plead, I offer sexual favors, whatever I can do to get my parts. But I got an offer, and it was for this big Steven Spielberg movie called The Help, which is based on a novel that's been on the New York Times bestseller list for 80 weeks or something. But it was not playing a gay character. And so he's a newspaper editor, and he's very brash and loud and this. And the reason I'm bringing this up was that there was an article in the L.A. Times about the director of the movie said this was a risk to hire Leslie Jordan to play this part. And I thought, why is it a risk?
He
said,
acting.
No, I love what they said. It was a bold choice that made people nervous.
Oh, yes.
I said, well, I'm glad no one told me, you know, that everyone was nervous.
You are an actor.
Yeah. I mean, I've played murderers. I've played, you know, I'm an actor. But I've sort of painted myself in the corner, especially with Will and Grace having been so popular.
Yeah, absolutely.
And winning an Emmy. We'll get that in. See, I dropped
absolutely.
That one in.
I read that your role in Will and Grace was originally intended for Joan Collins, is
it
that right?
It was.
You nicked it off her.
She hates me. I take all her parts. They wrote an episode where Megan Mullally's character, Karen Walker, was Joan Collins' character was going to steal Rosario the maid away from her, and then they were going to get into this dynasty cat fight over a billiard table and tell each other, you've done the worst thing a woman could do to another woman, steal her maid, and then we're going to pull each other's wigs off. And apparently, at the last minute, Miss Collins refused to have her wig pulled off, so they fired her. My theory is, and this is just my theory, there was also this huge miniseries called These Old Broads that Carrie Fisher wrote for her mother, Debbie Reynolds, and it was a peace offering. These were the stars. It was Debbie Reynolds, Elizabeth Taylor, Shirley MacLaine, and Joan Collins. Debbie Reynolds got her wig pulled off right in the beginning. Shirley MacLaine got her wig pulled off. So did Elizabeth Taylor, got her wig pulled off, but Miss Collins did not get her wig pulled off. So maybe it's a thing with her. I don't know.
Maybe.
But who cares? It was good for me, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And talking of your sort of brushes with celebrities, I heard that you have shared a prison cell with Robert Downey Jr.,
How did you find that out?
I was rather intrigued about.
I am 13 years sober. I love what they call it here. It's so polite. A drink problem. I was a drunken drug addict, okay? I had a little drink problem.
You've been very open and candid about this.
Well, you have to be. You know, they teach us in recovery, you're only as sick as your secrets. I have none.
Okay.
But I got two DUIs being drunk while I was driving.
Uh-huh.
And I was sentenced to 120 days, which is 3 months.
Oh.
I wasn't expecting this. I hired a lawyer. I paid him $4,000. When they sentenced me, he's waving like I'm leaving on a cruise. And they hauled me out of there. But on the 17th day of my unfortunate incarceration, I was told, we have good news, we have bad news. Good news, you're out.
Yeah.
We have Robert Downey Jr. downstairs. We have nowhere to put him. And I said, so what's the bad news? They said, well, the bad news is we can't let you out until the bars close because of your record. So it was 8 o'clock at night. The bars in California close at 2 a.m. So I had to share a cell with Mr. Robert Downey Jr. for
I bet a lot of people would quite like that.
Well, when I bumped into him years later, I got a job on Ally McBeal, and I thought, I hope when I meet him, he doesn't say, oh, yeah, remember, you were in jail with me.
So, it's when, always a nice greeting.
When I met him, he said, I know you, but I don't know from where. And I whispered it to him. I said, 152, pod A, cell 13. You were top, I was bottom. Which was,
I think that means something else.
The bunk beds. He looked at me and goes, what? I said, bunk beds. We were in jail together. He said, oh, my gosh.
I'll have to call him.
There was this young man on our cell block who was HIV positive, and he was treated unmercifully. Mm. The other prisoners wouldn't even eat with him, you know. And when I took my tray to eat near him, and they were going, he's got AIDS, don't sit near him. Yeah. And I sat down, and this young man got tears in his eyes, and he said, you don't have to do this. And I said, oh, yes, I do.
Yeah.
Yes, I do. Mm-hmm. And so when I got out, I was worried. I thought, who's going to watch after my poor friend? And so I wrote this letter, and I was privy to his address, 152, pod A, cell 13, top bunk. Yeah. And I just wrote R. Downey Jr., and I didn't know if he'd get it or not. And I said, you don't know me, but I shared a cell with you for about 7 hours. He was very sick. I don't know what he was coming off of. But I tend to be a little chatty, you know, and I was chatting away. But anyway, he said to me, when he met, I wrote him a letter and I said, I don't know you, but there's this kid, and maybe if you befriended him because you're a big movie star.
Yeah.
And
he did.
He did. And he also said to me with misty-eyed, he said, you wrote me that letter. And I said, oh my gosh, I had completely forgotten that. He said, I carried that letter with me my entire incarceration.
One other thing that, on a more serious note, I wanted to just quickly talk about before we have to wrap up, is that you're heavily involved in a gay teen suicide hotline in the States as well, aren't you? Tell us a bit about that quickly.
Well, that is why I wrote the book, because I had a friend who was worked at Simon & Schuster and said, look, just please write down all those dinner. And I thought, I'm not even on the D list with Kathy Griffin, who's this mad celebrity that my life on the D list. I'm not even, who would want to read why would I? Anyway, I read this alarming statistic when I work with a group called the Trevor Project, and it's a suicidal hotline for gay, we've added, it's gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, and questioning youth.
Yep.
We've added that. And when we plugged in almost 14 years ago, 15,000 calls within the first month from all over America, primarily
from the Bible
from
Belt.
From the Bible Belt, which is my story.
Yes.
I've been baptized 14 times. When we don't sprinkle, we dunk. You know, you couldn't wash me clean. The preacher would say, come forward, lost sinner. And I'd think, ooh, that's me. And I would run forward.
Yeah.
But I thought, you know, if this book can reach
help
one kid.
Yep. We have to wrap up for this week. My thanks go to Leslie Jordan. Tune in next week where we will be joined by
John
Martin.
Collins.
Joe Collins is coming in.
For her rebuttal.
In print and on stage, actor, author, playwright, and champion of LGBT and Q youth, Leslie Jordan's life story is called My Trip Down the Pink Carpet. His London radio host was Rosie Wilby. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. This week, Sarah Sweeney, Vosh Bodhi, Dixie Trichel, Sherry Lunn, and Rosie Wilby contributed program material. Thanks also to Jen Carrison and Steve Pride. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is made possible by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and by our generous listeners. Thank you. There's more information at thiswayout.org, where you can listen to our podcast, check out our blog, and link to our Facebook fan page. You can also hear This Way Out on iTunes. Follow TWO Radio on Twitter, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening on KWMD Kasilof, Alaska, 5PBA Salisbury, South Australia, QNation.fm Cleveland, Ohio, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now, y'all, stay tuned.
You have been listening to Queer Voices. Heard each Monday at 9 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles, and J.D. Doyle's Queer Music Heritage, which is produced in Houston. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Valensky. On-air voices are Brian Levinka, Jennifer Renee, J.D. Doyle, Glenn Holt, Summer Iman, and Jack Valensky. For more information about tonight's program, including links to websites and organizations mentioned during the show, visit queervoices.org. And you can send email to jack@queervoices.org. Be sure to listen to KPFT every Sunday morning, starting at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston, a Pacifica Foundation station. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
Listeners love KPFT and its programming. Pledge drives, not so much. So this summer, KPFT invites you to participate in a bold experiment and join the 10% of KPFT listeners who donate monthly to KPFT.
Visit KPFT.org today, click the Every Member Sustainer button, and do your part to increase that 10% of listeners sustaining to 100%.
With greater sustainer support, KPFT can give you more of the great programming you love. Sustaining members make KPFT's future income predictable and steady, providing the fiscal stability KPFT needs to have fewer pledge drive days.
$5, $10, $15, or $20 a month from you makes all the difference. So visit KPFT.org, click the Every Member Sustainer button, and become a sustainer of KPFT quickly and securely online.
You'll also be able to make sure your online donation goes to the credit of your favorite show, and you can pick out a thank you gift too.
Every Member Sustainer, join the club now at KPFT.org. I'm Gloria Johnson.
And I'm Sam Gonzalez from the Sharp Sound High School Broadcasting Program.
This is KPFT Houston.
I'm Sam Gonzalez from the Sharptown High School Broadcasting Program.
I'm Victoria Oluwole.
I'm Gloria Johnson.
I'm Darnell Anderson.
AFS is a worldwide nonprofit organization that has been leading international high school student exchange for more than 60 years.
Each year, AFS USA welcomes 2,500 international high school students who come to study in U.S. high schools and live with host families.
We are looking for families in the Houston area to become host families to students arriving in August.
To learn more about hosting for the 2011-2012 school year, visit afsusa.org/hostfamily.
This has been a public service announcement brought to you by the Broadcast Journalism Program at Sharptown High School.
This is KPFT Houston.
Widely seen as the channel of reference for coverage of the Middle East and Global South, Al Jazeera English can now be heard on 90.1 KPFT. Al Jazeera English has become a world leader in the coverage of Africa, Asia, the Middle East, Europe, and the Americas. You can hear Al Jazeera English weekdays from 5 to 6 a.m. on KPFT FM and HD1, or at 9 a.m. weekdays on KPFT HD2. Al Jazeera English has received many awards for its reporting. With a staff of more than 1,000 from 50 different countries, the aim of Al Jazeera English is to provide independent and impartial news for an international audience. Again, you can hear Al Jazeera English weekdays from 5 to 6 a.m. on KPFT and HD1, or at 9 a.m. weekdays on KPFT HD2.